become familiar lately with what seems to be a growing crisis, and that is the falling away of numerous adolescents from our communities, from Orthodox communities. And they're not just falling away in the ideological sense, but they're turning to lives of even delinquency, drug abuse, and crime. And this is not an isolated problem. This is a problem that exists, it would seem to be, in a widespread way. And there are already in existence numerous, but several programs to try to explore and find interventions and programs of treatment and correction for this problem. At the forefront of a lot of this work is a group of mental health professionals associated with an organization called Nefesh, which is a national organization of health professionals. And the vice president of Nefesh is with us this morning. His name is Dr. Norman Blumenthal, who is also the one of the founders and directors of an organization called Kahal, which works with these adolescents and their families. Dr. Blumenthal is with us this morning, and he has really a brand new, just produced videotape, which will show you these youngsters and their families, of course with their backs to the screen, that you won't see their faces, talking about the problem firsthand. Unfortunately, we're having a little technical problem with getting the video set up. We're working on it at this moment. We arranged with Hillel here to have a videotape, but for some reason, the director hasn't arrived yet. But we're working on it. But in the meantime, we'd like to ask Dr. Blumenthal to tell us his problem. And I want you to understand that Dr. Blumenthal knows his problem firsthand. He's not the knows about in an academic sense. But he's in there, he's gotten his hands dirty, training with some stories that if you had much hair, which your hair would stand on your head. It's a great privilege for me to introduce to you somebody who's really Mosa Nefesh for the Klal. There's a lot of very important work in the New York City area, Dr. Norman Blumenthal.
Thank you, everyone. It really is a very difficult time for me personally to get away this time of year. Mental health professionals tend to get very busy. Everybody's very tired, really just exiting off the days till the summer. So all stressors are at a peak, and everybody's practice is blossoming. And the Nefesh conference actually is starting tomorrow. And I took the shuttle this morning here. I'm shuttling back, of course, squeezing in some patients because the yeshiva still insists on tuition. And then running up to the homework tonight. But there's several reasons why I'm here today. One is, it's very hard for me to say no to Rabbi Weinrib. I'm not sure if you can appreciate this, although probably you can. Mental health professionals interface a great deal with Rabbanim. And it's very hard for a mental health professional to know what it is to be a Rav, and it's probably hard for a Rav to know what it's like to be a mental health professional. When you have someone like Rabbi Weinrib, who really has achieved the success that he has in both areas, it becomes an invaluable resource to us. So, and even if I thought of saying no to Rabbi Weinrib, I wouldn't dare say no to Rabbi Tzimchavi. So that's one reason why I'm here today. It's also, I'm here, and I would like to acknowledge that Rabbi Weinrib mentioned that there's a community effort that I'm involved with called Kahal, and there's an adolescent version called Tova, which I'll talk about very briefly, which is really a community effort. Every yeshiva and every shul in the five towns, Nassau County, Rockaway communities are involved. And we have present two Rabbanim who are active participants in this, Rabbi Hain and Rabbi Schwartz, and I certainly owe it to them for their and participation to be here. And then there's a third, maybe even more compelling reason why I'm here. A mental health professional who has a problem doesn't know what to do with it. You can't go to one of your colleagues because it'll spoil your reputation. So there's really, it's very hard to find some place or someone to whom to bare your soul. But like this Rabbanim Aritz, I'm going to confess to something. I have a tremendous yetzer hara for nekama. I love revenge. In fact, when we were putting Kahal together, Kahal had represented all the principals of the area. In the early years, we used to meet in my office, and I would tell the principals that this was Mida Keneged Mida, because as a child, I was always being sent to the principal's office. My life stream was someday I'd have an office, and get the principal to come to my office. And I had all the principals in my office. So I feel that way today also. Having been sermonized all my life, I finally can get even. Although I do recognize that some of you may belong to the Kiddush Club, and I'll certainly understand if you walk out on me. Let me tell you what the original plan was, so if I'm fumbling a little bit, you'll understand. My original plan was to present the problem, to raise the questions, and to let you watch the video to hopefully see if we can come up with the answers. We may have to sort of improvise, but if we get the video going, it really is a riveting video, and I hope you get to see it. But as Rabbi Weinrib mentioned, there is a tremendous escalating crisis in the community. In fact, one Rav in our community introduced the issue, which I thought was a very meaningful quote. He quoted the Panovitcher Rav, Zichrono Livracha, who said that a child who loses a parent becomes an orphan, and a community that loses children becomes an orphan. And there's a risk, and we are losing children. And I think part of it stems from our success. Oh, the technical man is here. Any hope? Okay. Wait, here you are. Oh, huh? We got it? Okay, great. Okay, then we'll go back to plan A. You have to rewind it, because I was playing a little bit. You have to rewind it at the beginning. Where the Orthodox community is experiencing unprecedented success, and I don't have to tell you what that is, you know that firsthand. But with that success and with every success comes failure. And there is a growing number of teens and young adults disenfranchised, feeling alienated from the community, and involved in some very hair-raising activities. They're on the streets. I'd say they're unemployed, although some of them make more money than I am, but I don't want to tell you how they're doing that. They're sexually promiscuous, they're drug involved, they're members of gangs, they're owners of chop shops. Okay, sure. Owners of chop shops, drug trafficking, and as Rabbi Weiner mentioned, it is hair-raising. And it's, you know, sometimes people ask me, well, you know, there were always kids who were misbehaving, there were always kids in trouble. How's it different today? And I think there are two basic differences. I think, at least when I was younger, there was a little room, Howie will test this, a little room for maneuverability. You could rebel a little bit. The community wasn't as demarcated, as polarized. Today, there's very little room. If you need to rebel, there's very little room for maneuverability. And you rebel all the way. And the other part that's, I think, different is that these kids are organized. There's a real network. You talk to one, they know the other. There's almost like a subculture. For example, I mentioned gangs. I understand that there are today two gangs in Borough Park and one gang in Flatbush of kids from homes. And it's a science to it. The black and Hispanic gangs do not admit Orthodox or Jewish kids. The Italian kids from Madison High School do. So it's already sort of a known thing. As I said, there's a science to this. Oh, yeah, that's it. Okay. You can rewind at the beginning. Okay. Yeah.
You ready when you are?
Okay, I'll tell you in a minute. Okay.
What's the percent?
In the New York metropolitan area, the estimates are that there are 1,000 to 3,000 kids in this matzav. We don't know exactly. There are particular hangouts. There are particular sites. Brooklyn, for example. The hangout, the Saturday night hangout, and by the way, you have to get up 2-3 in the morning to see this. You won't see this at 11 o'clock at night. Used to be the prime time billiards on Avenue P. That's out now, in case you're interested. Today it's the Playboy billiards on Coney Island Avenue. And I haven't been there, I've heard first-hand accounts of kids from the yeshivas, not only there, but there's apparently a basement nearby where they go down, get the drugs, Bifar Hesir, out in the open. By the way, this affects, as Rabbi Weinrib mentioned, this affects every community, and every subset of the Frum community. There's no, it's not like modern or Haredi or Hasidish, it's in every subset of the community. It's, just to give you an idea, let me just give you one sense. I'll go get to that, you're ahead of me. I want to just give you a sense of what, for example, what's the Shiloh of the 1990s. And it may be a little bit of a tease, because I don't know the answer to the Shiloh, but maybe at least you know what the Shiloh was. A Rav in our community, who was very active in Hatzalah, mentioned that he got a call at some ungodly hour, call either Saturday night or Sunday morning, depends how you look at it, from one of the Hatzalah volunteers. They were called to a party. The party were all kids from homes. There were drugs, there was all sorts of modern music, there was all sorts of preetzes, and one girl had either purposely or unintentionally overdosed and needed medical attention. And while they were attending to her, two more carloads of kids showed up for the party. And they took care of her, and they sent her off to the hospital. And then they took down the name and phone number of all the kids in the room. And their shaila was, do we call the parents and tell them, because the parents should know where their kids are? But if we do that, and we're rats, next time something like this happens, they won't call us, and this girl could have died. Now, the Rav basically said, this is too big a question for me. So I don't know what the answer was, and he referred them on. But maybe, you know, I guess if you want to use shilas and tshuvas as maybe a reflection of what's happening in community, that's the shila of the community today. Now, of course, somebody asked the very obvious question, who are these kids, how did it happen? And you can't clearly categorize them. So they come from, as I said, every subset, and many, by the way, you should know, come from extremely fine homes, people actively involved in Tzorchei Tzibur, and many have siblings who are the valedictorians and the top masmidim. We have some sense, and I'm going to leave that question open, because I think we have a small enough oilum here. I mean, when I'm presenting this to the Nefesh Conference with 500, I don't know if I'll have a chance to do this. But what I'd like to do is raise that as a question. How did this happen? Who are these kids? Not just for theory, not for sociological study. Can we identify them early? And this is a key question. Anyone knows a little bit about mental health? Early intervention is the key word. Can we identify these kids before they're on the street? And can we know who's at risk? What was the chadgadya that caused this to happen? And once it happens, what can we do? These are the questions. Why? Who are they? Can we identify them? What was the progression? And once they're there, what can we do? And I'm hopeful that the video will answer that question, or at least stimulate some conversation. We can watch the discussion, watch the video, and maybe we can talk about it together. I have my ideas, and I'll share them with you, but maybe you'll enlighten me as well. Let me tell you a little bit about the video, and then we can start. The video, first of all, was done under the auspices of Nefesh, so I do need to acknowledge Nefesh, who underwrote the video and actually gave me the opportunity to do this. It was done in collaboration with a colleague of mine, Rabbi Shimon Russell from Lakewood. Those of you who may know Shimon, he's Talmud Chacham and an outstanding clinician, and it was really a thrill to work with him on this. The interview is three people. One is an 18-year-old male, all of them, 18-year-old male from home, I'll leave it at that, a 16-year-old female from home, and then the mother of a 13-year-old. Now, when I showed this initially to some people, I mean, I'm not a professional filmmaker, so there was some confusion. Some people thought the mother was the mother of the 16-year-old. So let me make it clear, these are three distinct kids. Two of them interviewed directly, one, the story is told by the mother, but they have no connection to one another. In fact, one person who saw it thought that the mother was the mother of the 16-year-old, the 18-year-old was the boyfriend of the 16-year-old. I mean, we're Orthodox Jews, you know, I think he was ready to trace them to David HaMelech, but before we clarified this. So again, three kids, distinct kids. Think of the questions when you watch the video, and then we can discuss it. We're ready.
We need people downstairs to turn off the lights.
Okay, lights.
Tough, they should gonna disappear. They shouldn't disappear. to the dance, to the thing. She doesn't have to, she's going to sing and dance or take her to the street, but she and the kid that anybody would want to be friends with. And it got very popular. And, you know, these were the neighborhood kids, the non-Jewish kids, or the non-broke kids. And she started spending more and more time away from home. And then she started coming home with the lingo of gangs and with the hip hop music and almost zero tolerance for her family. Because her confidence was being boosted by those on the outside. And this was going on gradually, and I didn't know about it for a couple of times. But as she started getting her confidence, she was more assertive. She wanted us to know. And we started getting phone calls for somebody. We didn't know who it was. We thought it was the wrong number. What happened was she changed her name. She told me she was, so-and-so. And we got really upset about that. And anyway, she decided she wanted to try to change. She felt it was a madriga when she started hanging around with the Jewish kids that are from families also. They were also in trouble. And these kids were getting into drugs. And these kids were partying
scene over and over in my head, the man jogging when it's pitch black, and, you know, we're all so, everyone's so tired, and most of the world is sleeping or partying, you know. And here was a man who was jogging down the sidewalk in his Donkin sneakers.
The way I got reconnected was that toward the later years, I got into a very, very, very bad crowd. I mean, it was worse than any crowd I've ever been in. And these people were just doing more and more little things.
questions, and maybe we can discuss it, and perhaps this has lent some light, shed some light. Huh? Oh, okay. I got the word that we don't have time for discussion. I'm sorry. Let me share with you then some
of
the.
Want to react?
Maybe you can have. All right. I got permission. Any reaction?
Talk.
Huh? I should talk. Okay.
Teacher.
I don't know. I don't know. All right. We have, in fact, Brother Russell and I put together what we consider the at-risk factors for these kids, and I think some of it you may have heard in the tape. I think if there's a generality, and again, the point is, let me start with one point. The sense is that we can identify these kids way before adolescence. Obviously, as you can see in the tape, it really goes haywire, junior high school. But the seeds of what's happening are quite apparent already by fourth grade and maybe even earlier. A disproportionate number of these kids, as for example, the boy was a case, are learning disabled. And particularly the learning disabled kids whose needs are not addressed, whether they're thrown out, and I'll get to the throwing out business in a minute, or whether they're warehoused. A lot of these kids have various types of learning disabilities. A lot of the kids have an attention deficit disorder, ADD. And again, those of you who don't know what ADD is, it's what you're experiencing right now while I'm talking. It's attention. You know, it's an inability to focus. They live on Ritalin, right. But again, a lot of these kids fit that category. A lot of the kids are just average, as if there was something wrong with that. But it's come to the point in our community that being average, having 100 IQ, if you will, really sets you apart. And I will hear from Prince, well, he has 100 IQ, what do you expect? He can't be, he can't learn till 3-4, he can't be a masmid, he can't finish shas, he can't be the doctor, lawyer, Indian chief. And I'm not even talking already with those maybe below average IQ, although, to tell you the truth, a lot of these kids in the street are quite bright, because they wouldn't make it on the streets. I mean, these are kids who work with, again, I can tell you from my own experience, work with some of the meanest, nastiest guy, and will go right up to the drug deal and handle with them. So you got to be on the ball. But again, to say learning disabilities or at least average abilities. Yes, some come from dysfunctional homes. Some come from divorce, some from homes with his mental illness, but not necessarily. And don't naturally assume that. As I said, many of these homes, you can hear from the stories here, the parents of these kids are major figures in their respective communities. Adopted children are at risk. An interesting thing about all three of these kids, and we have seen that, all three of these kids, two of them have an immediate younger sibling. One had an immediate younger sibling who was born with a very rare disease and died after a few months. One had an immediately younger sibling who had needed several types of transplants, had a very serious physical ailment, of which he's not out of the woods yet. And the mother had taken in a foster child whom she's attempting to adopt and is involved in a custody battle over this child, not the immediately younger sibling, but I think one down. So having a sibling with problems, which consumes the parents, appears to put these kids at risk. Having a sibling who's gifted, something we think would be wonderful, but what happens when your immediately older child is such an exceptional child? What happens to that kid when he comes into the next class with the same teacher? You know, why can't you be like? Those kind of issues. Some of the children, it's an issue of neglect. And here I'm touching I'm skating a little bit on thin ice, but I don't mean outright neglect. But I'm talking about family size. And this is an issue, particularly among Baalei Tshuva. You know, there's a sense among many Baalei Tshuva that you have to have a lot of children, and this is a very important way of being from. Not aware of the fact that this is a shiloh that you can ask, and very few people do ask this. Rabbanim tell me, I'm not saying Rabbanim tell me, even from more yeshivish communities, they don't get shilohs about birth control, etc. But I say particularly Baalei Tshuva families, because some people from large from homes themselves, they usually have an extended family. Very often they live in the same community with aunts, uncles, grandparents. There's a lot of surrogate parents. They grew up in a large family. They know the mechanism of 10 children, 12 children. Someone who grew up in the typical American 2.1 children or whatever it is, don't have severed ties for practical purposes with their family, and now have the 5, 7, 10 children, can't manage. And not all the children get necessarily the attention. I think the mother spoke to that very clearly. And again, we have to take a lot out. That's a consideration. Another consideration, and again, this is one that is complicated, is the issue of two working parents. And again, I'm not saying that can't be, and I'm against it. The realities, the economic realities is, and more so, that we need two working parents. The reality is that many women find a great deal of fulfillment working and have the right and should have that opportunity. But how does it work? What's the mechanism? Are there staggered working hours so the children aren't getting attention? Who is covering when a parent can't be home? Is it a 9-to-5 job or is it a 9-to-9 job? And these are issues that are important in terms of identifying the factors. There are other related issues. I'll go very quickly. It helps to be good looking. It helps to be strong. It helps to have street savvy. Helps to be thrill seeking. And there are many other issues. I mean, the mother mentioned that her daughter's very pretty. That helped if you were going to make it out in the street. In terms of reaching out, I mean, these are the at-risk factors. And I think what we're trying to say, and I was hoping this would evolve in conversation or discussion, but I think it's important that the yeshivas realize. I mean, I can quote you the famous Rashi on Vayigdalu Hanarim, when they say, why didn't they realize what's going on with Esav? And they say, oh, he's just misbehaving. I think yeshivas have to realize that it's in fourth grade, maybe even in nursery, maybe even in kindergarten, that we got to find these kids and we got to service them before it becomes this problem, and how important early intervention is. And identifying these problems and taking care of them. And one more issue, and that's when the kids are out there, and the kids said it better than I could. Don't sever ties, don't break the connection, don't. You have three types of kids in your school. You have the strong kids that are really, you know, solid, and they're impervious. They're not going to be affected by these kids. You have the kids that are getting involved in all sorts of activities that you heard. But then you have the marginal kids. You have the Beinoni. And those kids can go either way, and they don't want to fight over those kids. And I hear them. And there's a point. And I'm not saying they're throwing out is the answer. I'll propose some other answers, but I can hear. But when you throw a kid out because they're not cutting the mustard academically, and when you say to a kid, you can't learn Baba Kama from 9 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon, you have no place in the frum community. As far as I'm concerned, that's inexcusable, and that's what I think the kids are saying to. There's a lot, I don't want to lecture you, but there's a lot to Torah, and there's a lot to being a frum Jew. Or as a Rav very involved in Kahal puts, I think he puts it beautifully, the hand has 5 fingers, if they're all the same, useless. And there's many ways to be a member of the frum community, and I think we have to reconsider it, and I think the yeshivas have to reconsider it. Running out of time? Okay. I'll be around if there are any questions. Okay.
All right, Rabbi, a few things. First of all, I want to thank Dr. Norman Blumenthal.